Welcome, everybody. This is Then and Now. I'm Brad Sham. You are, by way of full disclosure, going to hear some ambient sound behind us because we are recording this episode of Then and Now at the Ford Center at the Star in Frisco, just before and during the early stages of a Cowboys practice before the third preseason game. Why are we doing that? Because this is our opportunity to sit down with one of the greatest names in American sports broadcasting, Al Michaels. Thank you very much.
Boy, that was the perfect introduction. Get a little ambient sound in there. Put me in this legendary. I'm very nervous about being called legendary these days.
Did I call you legendary?
Well, no, you didn't, but it was kind of like euphemistically. Worked around the corner.
Al, don't project.
Legendary to me sometimes now means.
Former and retired. And perhaps dead.
And perhaps. You summed it up. I didn't want to say it, but I'm glad you said it.
You're not that far ahead of me, and that's why I know.
Oh, boy.
The beauty of this series has been that it is what the title says. It's then and now. And so I think I would like to start with a little now, since we are recording this before you're in town to do a Cowboys preseason game. Probably folks will first hear this just before the Cowboys play a game that you and Chris do in the regular season, and so this is true not just of now, but of all the time you've been doing the NFL. Why are the Cowboys such gold for television?
Brad, I think it goes back, as you would know very well, probably to when the franchise got good. I mean, they come into the league in 60, and then it's a slow start, but then Tom Landry is here for so many years. Tremendous success. Of course, they're known as America's team, and then people mock that. But in a way, they still are, in a sense, because I know when I tell people I live in Los Angeles, and they say, what's the game this week? If I say it's the Jaguars against the Titans, they'll go, hmm? But if I say it's the Cowboys against anybody, their eyes kind of open up a little wider, and they say, oh, that's cool. No matter how the Cowboys are faring at that point. And I think, obviously, when Jerry Jones comes in, and there's always a story around the Cowboys, always, no matter what their record is. And look, you sat through a lot of pretty bad seasons, 1-15, and some bad times. And then the times got really good, and then they sort of waffled again. The Cowboys have been on this, real roller coaster. And people like to mock them because of the lack of success in postseason and all of that. And, America's team, and that's mocked a lot, as I say. But this, I don't know, it rings. There's something about just Dallas Cowboys that rings. And if the Dallas team was known as the Jaguars, that wouldn't work. But the Cowboys, I mean, the Cowboy is such an iconic American figure. It speaks to the state of Texas. It speaks to Dallas. And so you put all of these things together, and there's still something magical about the Dallas Cowboys. And as you know, we can't get enough Cowboy games. And I was once asked, what would it take for the Cowboys to get off Sunday Night Football? And I said, 5 years of going 2-14 and the franchise moves to Albuquerque. That would get them off Sunday Night. That's the only thing I can think. It would get them off Sunday Night Football.
You have had, of course, all of the big moments in the NFL that have come up on Sunday Night games. You've done Super Bowls. I hope I don't need to remind anyone of things like the 1989 World Series and the Miracle on Ice. And if I do, then shame on you people and go look it up. We were lucky enough to have one of my longtime friends and early mentors, Vern Lundquist, on this program. And I asked him to observe about something that I'm also going to apply to you. You, citing as evidence 89 and the Miracle on Ice and the big moments. I don't think it's all accident that a small handful of people get the biggest moments put in front of them. You could do Monday Night Football and Sunday Night Football all your life and never have had something like the Miracle on Ice.
Correct.
You could do the World Series from time immemorial and never have 1989. My contention is, whatever you're leaning, God, the universe, whatever it is, puts those moments in front of the people who can handle it, as many of them as you had, do you ever reflect on, how did I get this again?
I think a lot of it is luck. I mean, you go back to really the seminal moment in my career, it would be 1980, it would be the Olympics, it would be the United States hockey team winning the gold medal. And I get that assignment because I am the only broadcaster at ABC, and I've got Mount Rushmore right there. Howard Cosell, Jim McKay, Chris Schenkel, Keith Jackson, you name it, they're there, Frank Gifford. And I get that assignment because when they go down the list of people who have done hockey games, I had done one, and none of those guys had done any. So otherwise, I'm probably doing the biathlon or the ski jump, and there were no miracles out on those hills, let me tell you. So that was a rabbit's foot. That fell into my lap. Here I'm there for what Sports Illustrated ranked as the greatest sports event of the 20th century. And I just let, you know, my heart guide me. People say to me all the time, you know, where did that come from? Do you believe in miracles? Yes. Did you think about it beforehand? The answer, absolutely not. I went into those Olympics thinking, you know, if the U.S. can win a bronze medal and kind of stay in the game, every game, that's all you could ask for. And then all of a sudden they go on this insanely magical run, and do you believe in miracles came out of my heart. And that's also one of the very few events that a broadcaster can be assigned to where the crowd isn't 50-50 or 60-40. They're 99.9.01. I mean, this is, you know, we think about what's going on with us in Russia today, but think about it then. It was crazier. And so
just think about that. It was crazier.
It was crazier. It certainly was. I mean, we wound up boycotting their Olympics in 80, and they paid us back by boycotting the Los Angeles Olympics in 1984. And we were at loggerheads with each other, and the Cold War was very cold. So when I come up with those words, would that have worked at the end of the Philadelphia-New England Super Bowl? Of course not. Everybody in New England would have said, what the hell is he talking about? But at the end of that game, it was my heart coming to my brain, and basically, do you believe in miracles? Yes. And it kind of put the stamp on it. Even at that time, when I say that, Brad, I have no idea. I'm calling the game, and the Soviets are putting pressure on the United States team, and I'm thinking, you got to stay with the game. They could score. This could be tied. A lot of stuff is going on the ice. So when those words come out, it comes out of my heart, period, and, you know, fortunately, it kind of holds up a little bit.
And this is one of the, I'll bet it is for you, I know it is for me, one of the most asked questions. And so I'm wondering how that moment informed everything you did after that. Do you prepare what you're going to say? And I always say the same thing you just did. I'm no good at that. It comes to you or it doesn't. But when you have a signature moment dropped in your lap like that, for any period of time, did it make you think, oh, I got to make sure that everything else I do lives up to that?
No. Because I've always felt that spontaneity is the essence of our business. If you go in, and I know that a couple of broadcasters in the late 90s called me when Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa were chasing the Maris home run record. And a couple of the guys said to me, should I be thinking about something? And I said,
how do I write something like you wrote for the Olympic hockey?
Right. What, and I said, look, you know, you don't know when it's coming. You know, he could be right on the cusp. You know, McGwire got there first. And I said, look, everything is going to sound rehearsed. And also, tell me what that home run is going to look like. Is it a bomb into the upper deck? Is it down the left field foul line, fair or foul, which you don't know? Will it be, not that, you know, the odds of this were like 100-1. Could it be an inside the park home run? So where are you going? Call the home run. Then whatever comes into your mind and heart, then say it. But if you script it, it will sound like it's scripted. So that would be my advice to any broadcaster who knows that there might be a seminal moment in their career coming up. How do you want to call it? To me, it's like, don't overthink it. If you've gotten to the point where you're in a position to call some of these events, you've got to trust yourself. You got there for a reason. Trust that the right thing will come out.
You mentioned that the 1980 Olympic hockey game was perhaps the seminal moment in your career. We're now into the kind of the then part of the then and now, which right. This is what I really enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned that was the seminal moment. So you think that was bigger than working on the dating game and finding women for Chuck Barris to put on television?
It slightly exceeded it. It was close. But I actually, before I started my broadcasting career, and I got out of Arizona State, and I got married to a woman by the name of Linda. And Linda and I are going to celebrate another anniversary on the 27th of August in a couple of days.
Mazel tov.
Thank you very much. And I found the right lady. And she was also working at Chuck Barris Productions at the time. So she was keeping an eye on her newlywed groom, who was in a position with right, with a few other guys, and we would be there during the day, and we would try to we'd call up a number of girls and guys, both come down to audition, and then we would have a run through. We'd play the game with them, and very often I would play the role of Jim Lang, who was the host of the show, in the run through in the
did
office.
Did you like that?
I did. I really did. And in those years, you know, I worked there. That was my placeholder between graduating from college and starting my broadcasting career. And Jim Lang was the host of the dating game, and Bob Eubanks was the host of the Newlywed Game, which had just started. And we spent a lot of the day auditioning these people in the office, and I would get to play the host role. So I might have been a game show host.
I would,
turned out differently.
I'd put a Nielsen box in my house to watch you run an episode of that. So maybe some people didn't know that about the start of your career, or about the fact that you worked a couple of games with Chick Hearn.
Correct.
But only a couple.
About 10, actually, but I barely got on the air. So I wanted to get into
and
broadcasting.
Chick Hearn, for those of you who don't know, for crying out loud, was the legendary voice of the Los Angeles Lakers.
Iconic. As good a basketball announcer as I've ever heard. And Chick did the Lakers forever. So what happened was, I went to work for Chuck Barris, which is crazy enough as it is. I mean, Chuck was a very unusual man. I loved him. And he...
which, by the way, excuse me, you don't get that job if you're not living in L.A., right?
That would be correct. Oh, yeah, what happened was, Chuck knew I wanted to get into broadcasting. He said, hey, when an opportunity comes along, take it. You know, there'll always be a job back here for you. But so the opportunity came along. I knew somebody who got me into PR with the Lakers. And at that time, the Los Angeles Kings had just been granted an expansion franchise. So they are now coming into the league. And they're playing at the Sports Arena in L.A., but very much as Jerry built the not only the Star, but obviously AT&T Stadium, Jack Kent Cooke owned the team, and he wanted to build the greatest indoor arena in the country. And he built the Forum, which still exists, and at that time was probably the number one arena in the country, the Forum in Inglewood, which is now a concert venue. So I get a job in PR, and the next thing I know, they know I want to get into broadcasting in the office, and Chick Hearn had worked for years solo. He didn't want an analyst. He didn't want anybody with him. Maybe a guy to keep stats. So Jack Hancock, as I found out later, had in mind, he wanted to bring in the recently retired Hot Rod Hundley to be Chick's partner. Rod had retired, had a great personality, would go on to, you know, announce New Orleans and Utah for years. Really, you know, good guy. But Chick didn't want that to happen. So what Cook did, I only knew this on the back end, I was going to be the sacrificial lamb. He was going to take a 22-year-old kid and put him in with Chick to be the analyst for the Los Angeles Lakers, who at that time had Jerry West and Elgin Baylor on the team. So I've known those guys since I was a child. I mean, I'm I get on the range with Jerry West like last week. Jerry still, you know, belongs to the same club I do. So I've known Jerry 18 million years. Anyway, we go back to that, and Chick, the only time Chick allows me on the air is like at halftime and at the end of the game to read the stats. So we do, I think, 4 preseason games, and then we got something like 6 or 8 regular season games. I'm there. I'm traveling with the team, but I'm not doing anything. And this was to get Chick to accept a real analyst, and that turned out to be Hot Rod Hundley, who supplanted me.
You really were a sacrificial lamb.
I was a sacrificial lamb. And I know that I got fired Went back to work for Chuck Barris. And I think I wrote in my book that, a few years later, it would have been like 18 or 19. First Super Bowl I do is Washington against Denver in 1980, after the 87 season in San Diego. Redskins win it. Jack Kent Cook is the owner of the team and has the audacity to tell a writer that he gave me my start and I owe my career to him. And I called the writer and I said, "This is so much BS. Stop it." I said, "The guy almost got me out of the business, not through it."
Okay, in the few minutes we have left, we cannot advance without explaining the role that Oswald the Rabbit plays in your life.
Right. So Oswald was came from the imagination of Walt Disney, and he created Oswald. And then when Walt went from, I think, whatever the predecessor of Universal Studios was, to form his own studio, and he wanted to take Oswald with him, but they didn't allow that to happen legally, whatever. So he then created Mickey Mouse. And Mickey Mouse looked like Oswald. So a rabbit looked like a mouse, but whatever. I mean, they look like twins. So I'm at ABC. As luck would have it, I'm at ABC for 30 years. And then they decide that they're not going to do Monday Night Football on ABC anymore, which they had done for 20. I had done for 20 of the 30 years. And they were going to put Monday Night on ESPN and that would be the only package they would have. They had the opportunity to have both Sunday and Monday. They had the right of first refusal, Disney did, but did not take it, and wound up having Monday night on ESPN, and then Dick Ebersole came in from the other door to get Sunday night for NBC. So what happens
from
is,
the other door,
at ESPN, they put some people in charge who had the brilliant foresight to fire John Madden, or just say we don't want him anymore. Take Fred Godelli, our producer, and put him on auto racing or whatever. Take Drew Esikoff, our director, put him someplace else, and bring in their own people, a couple of whom who were doing Sunday Night Football. And I'm kind of like, I'm sort of in the middle of this thing because I can't. Ebersole wants me to come over to Sunday Night. And I loved Monday night, but now I'm thinking, oh, man, and my guys...
You don't have the same team.
Correct. I would have been paired with Joe Theismann. And I was going to lose John Madden, who I loved, and we had worked together for 4 years. Anyway, to make a long story a little bit shorter here, I go to them after I had agreed the year before to stay there and do Monday night, but I can't sleep at night. My stomach is churning. It's just not the right thing for me. I'm not the guy to do what they want to have done.
I knew that in my
John's going over, and Freddie and Drew, who are still my producer and director. I mean, think about that. And win 18 gazillion Emmys. And they went their way, fine. But I knew I had to get out of there. So I had to call who I had to call and say, look, this isn't going to work. I said, I don't want to break a contract here, but I got to tell you something. I think this is great for both of us. And there was some resistance on the ESPN side about that, because how was that going to look after I agreed to stay? And it wasn't going to look really good. So they went to, but I was going to get to do to make the move. And Disney goes to NBC and basically says, "All right, we're going to let Al out of this, but we need something in return." So they got some extra Ryder Cup rights. Some Olympic rights that since NBC had the Olympics. So there's going to be something that makes it look as if. So I get a call from Bob Iger, who I'd started with at ABC in 1976. And he said he had gotten a call from the Disney family. And the Disney family had said...
The Disney family,
whoever, a cousin and what,
yeah.
Somebody. I mean, Walt's long gone. I don't know whether it was Roy Disney. I don't know who it was. But somebody in the Disney family said they always dreamed about getting the rights to Oswald the Rabbit back. And Bob didn't even know what the hell they were talking about. So they researched this, and Bob calls, I think, Ron Meyer at Universal, and he said, "Well, yeah, this is a thing, but we don't even know what this is. It's in the vault somewhere." So we come up with this plan, that, hey, if we throw this thing into the deal, then the press won't think there's something nefarious and insidious going on behind the scenes. What do you think? And I go, sounds good to me. And sure enough, instead of it being, you know, Michaels breaks contract or kind of a bad guy is this, we throw the rabbit in there. And what becomes the story? The rabbit. But, Brian, I can only tell you this. That deal was 1,000% done without the
rabbit. Without the rabbit.
Right. So when people say you get traded for a rabbit, I go, yeah, okay, right.
Do you at least have a big stuffed Oswald the rabbit somewhere in the
house? Oh, yeah. They sent me everything. Okay, and I got it, and I gave it to my granddaughter.
Okay,
and she loves it. So it was
perfect. Fantastic. All right.
It worked out great.
Last one,
sure.
And I can't begin to thank you enough for your years of friendship and for your time today. So some people may not know that you were the team broadcaster for the San Francisco Giants, for the Cincinnati Reds, and before that in minor league baseball for the Hawaii Islanders.
Right.
And I wonder if you talked about you wanted to get into broadcasting when you were at Arizona State. I wonder if when you were doing the Hawaii Islanders, all of this last 30, 40 years, would that
almost
ever...
Almost 50.
Would that ever have crossed the vistas of your imagination that this is what it might lead to?
I dreamed about it, I'll tell you that.
About this biggest stage?
Correct. When I'm a kid, and I'm growing up in Brooklyn, and my father takes me to Ebbets Field and to the New York football Giants games, to the Knicks, to the Rangers, to everything. Army football on Saturdays up at West Point. And I wanted to get into broadcasting, and I dreamed big. I said, man... You know, I want to do the World Series. The Super Bowl didn't exist. I want to do the Olympics. So I had these, you know, huge dreams. And then all of a sudden, wow, when I'm in Cincinnati, and if you're the team won the pennant and you were the number one announcer, you got to do the World Series on national television.
Right.
I'm 26 years old. I'm with Kurt Gowdy, Tony Kubek doing Reds A's in 1972. I'm going, you know, thinking to myself, God, you can just let me finish this World Series and then you can take me away, whatever the hell you want to do with me. So all this, you know, it comes to fruition. You get the Olympics. And I will tell you this. I look at it backwards now and I go, oh, my God, how did that happen? From the front end, as a kid, dream big. And I always tell kids when I talk to them, what's wrong with dreaming big? And I dreamt all these dreams. And then the Super Bowl came along that wasn't even in existence. And I never thought about doing like the Stanley Cup Finals and the NBA Finals and all that stuff happened. I look back and I went, whew, there's a lot of right place, right time in there. A lot. Because I just happened to be at certain moments in time exactly where I needed to be so that I could, you know, get on the trampoline. And Hawaii had a lot to do with that too. Because when I was doing minor league baseball in Hawaii, our franchise was probably the most successful minor league franchise of its time. And Chuck Tanner was our manager in Hawaii. But one of the funniest things is our big rival was the Spokane Indians. And Spokane at that time, this is 1970, they were the Dodgers.
The Dodgers
AAA Farm Club. The Spokane Indians in 1970 had Steve Garvey, Davey Lopes, Bill Russell, Bobby Valentine, Ron Say, and managed by Tommy Lasorda. Okay? So they are our big rival. And because of travel, they would come over like for a week at a time, twice a year. So I got to know those guys. And Lasorda always loves to tell the story.
You didn't ever go out with any of those guys, did you?
Well, you didn't really go out necessarily, but you knew them, and I was around them a lot, and they got to know me, and we're all the same age.
Okay.
So, and then I got to know a lot of them. And a lot of them became my partners on the air. So, Lasorda loves to tell the story about they're over there, and Al Campanis is the general manager of the Dodgers at that time. And so, Lasorda would call in after the game to report on how the guys did. You know, Valentine did this, and Buckner did this, but Buckner's on that team too. Garvey, boom, boom. So, he calls him one night, and he says, hey, he says, Al, he said, hey, by the way, I know, you know, Vinny's great, and Vinny will be there a long time, Scully. He said, but there's a guy over here. There's a young guy over here. This guy is really, really good. He's a really good announcer. You know, you should just, you know, keep your eye on him in case something happens down the line. His name is Al Michaels. Okay. So Campanis goes, you know, he says, oh, okay. And then starts asking about the rest of the team. And then Campanis, at the end of the conversation, says, Tommy, this guy you're talking about, this Michael's kid, how do you know he's any good? Lasorda says, I've been thrown out of the last four games. I've been out in the clubhouse listening to him. Now, Tommy, of course, there's a little embellishment here. But what truly happened was Tommy gets thrown out of a game in the fourth inning. Then the next night he gets thrown out when he brings the lineup card out, right? Then he lasts the third game. And then the fourth game, what happens is he gets thrown out like the seventh inning. So he true. And in Hawaii, the clubhouse wasn't behind the dugout. You would have to walk 430 feet past the center field fence and then another 150 feet into the clubhouse. You couldn't sneak back into a little tunnel behind the dugout. So Lasorda truly is out there listening to me. And it was so ironic. I think back to those days. And the guy who threw him out three times wound up having the longest career of any major league umpire, Bruce Fremming. I think about this. You got Bruce Fremming there. You got Tanner on one side. I would wind up doing the World Series in 1979 when Chuck is at Pittsburgh. The interconnections. And like I say, Brad, I mean, look, this is just a way to say I cannot believe how lucky. I mean, I could have been doing minor league baseball someplace else. None of this might have happened. The Cincinnati Reds hear about me. That leads to Cincinnati, which leads to San Francisco, which leads to ABC, which leads to NBC. And we got Oswald in the middle of this. What can I tell you?
And Oswald the Rabbit, and here we are watching practice.
Here
at the
we are
Star.
Watching yeah. the Dallas Cowboys. I can't believe what, you know, Jerry Jones, to me, I mean, we know what a major figure he is in this country. And people say, what do you think of the Jerry Jones? And all I can say is I've known Jerry a long, long time. He built the greatest stadium that I've ever seen in Arlington. I mean, that's the best. Maybe the one in L.A., I don't know. If L.A.'s any better, it's only because Jerry talked to Stan Kroenke about how to build a stadium.
He's involved in it. Right,
he's involved. And then I walk in here and I'm going, wait a minute, look at this. Who has a practice facility like this? Who? I mean, this is insane. It's amazing. And I think everything that Jerry has done in his life has been top grade, first class. You know, he never cuts corners, never on anything. An amazing man, amazing.
And so are you. You say right place, right time. I say someone had a plan. And your passion and enthusiasm still come across like 50 years ago. So keep going, and thank you. Thanks for the time.
You know, it's still exciting, Brad. Yeah. You know that too, right?
I
you
do.
Walk in, you know, you walk in, the stadium fills up. It's about the coolest job ever invented.
Ever.
Thanks, Brad.
Al Michaels. This is Then and Now. I'm Brad Sham.
Then and Now with Brad Sham is a production of Vocal. For more information and more programming, please visit vocalnow.com. That's VOKALnow.com.